their ears filled with the engine sounds of the German Gotha bombers dropping their lethal cargo of death and destruction, and the sounds of bullets, mortar, and artillery shells snuffing out the lives of hapless victims, many of whom were close friends and fellow airmen. Below them lay the battlefields of St. Mihiel, where the 1st American Army fought under its own leaders for the first time, and countless fallen comrades earned their eternal reputation for bravery and self-sacrifice in the pursuit of freedom for unknown friends and allies. As the flight passed Verdun, flying over the pockmarked fields of bomb craters, trenches, and rusting barbed wire, and over the Argonne Forest, each of the crew felt the presence in their cockpits of those ace airmen who had flown into battle with them and against them and changed the face of war forever. The fields below them, even disguised with a new mantle of green, evoked the great air battles of years gone by. In each cloud, their mind's eye could clearly see the Allied Spads and Nieuports of Billy Mitchell, Eddie Rickenbacker, Raoul Lufberry, and Frank Luke, locked in mortal combat with the Iron Cross-marked albatrosses and Fokkers of Manfred von Richthofen, Ernst Udet, Eric Lohenhard, and Werner Voss. As they approached the outskirts of Paris, their reveries appeared to come to life. Closing on them rapidly from the front was a military formation of 8 biplanes. Instinctively, Smith signaled the arrival of the unknown airplanes to Wade and Nelson and pointed to the nearest cloud formation into which they could take shelter. Fighting against the impulse to break formation and noting no hostile intent from the growing images in his widescreen, Lowell recognized them as French airplanes sent to escort them to Paris. The Chicago led the growing V formation in a large circle over the Eiffel Tower, the spires of Notre Dame, the impressive buildings on the left bank of the Seine River, the dome of the Opera, and the vast wings of the Louvre. Descending over the Garden of the Tuileries, Lowell continued at rooftop level up to the Champs-Élysées, dipping his wings in salute when he passed just above the Arc de Triomphe. Millions of Parisians, tightly packed in the streets below, waved delightedly at the flight. Lowell made a climbing turn for their landing at Le Bourget. Noting the huge crowds awaiting his arrival, Lowell was thankful that no one ran into the path of the planes as they landed. It was just 5:15 p.m. when the three world cruisers parked in front of the waiting hangars at Le Bourget. It took a full hour before the flyers could finish shaking the hands of the vast array of high officials that had come to greet them and began the job of servicing up the airplanes. Most of the dignitaries waited for them patiently until well after 9 o'clock, when the work finally finished. Exhausted, they climbed into waiting limousines and were taken to their hotel rooms, where a specially prepared French version of a typical American dinner awaited them. With great effort, they showered, cleaned off most of the grease, and looked forward to nothing more than a good night's sleep. That was not to be. They had no sooner gotten into bed than the door opened, and a delegation including most of the French cabinet ministers entered, explaining they had prepared a magnificent evening in honor of their American airmen guests. Not wishing to offend their kind hosts, Lowell reluctantly accepted on behalf of the crew, and they all warily dressed again for what they hoped would be a very short evening. It was now almost midnight, and they were all dead tired. Entering a specially prepared box at the Folies Bergères, they were startled to hear each of their names called by the dazzlingly beautiful showgirls who promised them the best performance of their lives to the suggestive, envious snickers of the audience. In groups and singly, the amply endowed showgirls pranced and danced next to them, sensuously revealing charms usually hidden from view. In the darkened theater, lighted only by the spotlights on the showgirls, one by one the weary crew fell fast asleep. The lack of sleep of the previous week, followed by 10 hours of flying that day before 5 additional hours servicing the planes, had taken its toll. As the spotlight was turned on the Americans, the surprised French hosts found themselves among loudly snoring Americans, totally oblivious to the charms paraded before them. Despite sharp nudges in their ribs from their hosts each time a beguiling spectacle began, they would awaken startled momentarily and then relapse into a deep sleep. The French audience could hardly comprehend the American reaction to what they found to be an enormously interesting and compelling show. An enterprising reporter took several photographs of the Americans soundly sleeping at the feet of their stunning showgirls, and the Paris newspaper headlines the next day questioned, "If the Folies Bergère won't keep these American airmen awake, we wonder what will." The masculinity of the crew, and Americans in general, were called into question. They became the butt of jokes in most of the world's newspapers, which they took with good humor. An unexpected result was that tens of thousands of women the world over became anxious to prove that their charms could certainly overcome the diffidence of the Americans. Les Arnold offered to give each of them a chance. When the crew finally returned to their hotel late that evening, they wrote the following notice and put one on each of their doors. "Please do not wake us until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning unless the hotel is on fire. And not even then unless the firemen have given up all hope.